From WBUR of Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. CARE International has provided aid to Afghanistan since 1968 and Iraq since 1991, two of the many countries it has served, from Brazil to Mali, Yemen to Nepal. CARE works with the world's poorest to alleviate their suffering and eradicate their poverty. Up next, On Point, the president of CARE USA talks about humanitarian aid in an inhumane world. We begin in Washington, where a CIA report has spurred the administration to accelerate the transfer of power to Iraqis. The report warns that the situation in Iraq is spiraling out of control. Julian Borgia is a reporter for London's Guardian newspaper. I asked him how the report was leaked and the motives of its leakers.
It was leaked obviously very quickly because it arrived over the weekend and it was in the press within hours. It was clear that the idea was to make sure that this message got out and it wasn't overlain by the more optimistic projections being put on it by some of the hawks in the Pentagon and in the Vice President's office. So it was a number of leaks. I mean, this document lands on the tables of most of the principals among the president's national security advisors and the deputy principals as well.
And what does the report say?
Well, the report says that they've got a serious problem in Iraq and that the insurgency isn't a question of a few remnants and it's not a question of a few jihadists coming across the border, that it does have a significant foothold in Iraqi society. And if it's perceived that the U.S. is not coming to grips with it, and that there is a possibility, at least, that the old regime might return, then the problem will begin to escalate as more and more people decide to side with the insurgents and away from the coalition.
Now, this CIA report includes an estimate, I think, from Pentagon sources, that something like 50,000 people are involved in one way or another in the resistance.
Well, it's not in the CIA report. This was a military intelligence estimate. The CIA report, as far as I know, doesn't give a figure, and this figure came out of the Pentagon. And what it seems to be, after hearing General John Abizaid speak the other day, he said there were 5,000 insurgent fighters, and this suggests that that 50,000 figure that comes from military intelligence is just a straight multiplication by 10, because it's part of military doctrine that if you're fighting guerrilla warfare, that for every guerrilla fighter, there'll be 10 other supporters necessary to provide shelter, to provide transport, to provide cover for each one of those fighters. So if you have 5,000 fighters, that means there are at least 50,000 people out there that are on their side and working with them.
The administration has reacted to this report by changing its strategy rather dramatically. Can you give us a quick sense of what it changed and from what to what?
Well, what they're doing now is to try and find ways of speeding up the whole process of handing over sovereignty and getting elections. And the unwritten add-on to that is to getting out of there in time for the elections. And it's become clear that the very sort of meticulous, ordered way they were going to do that, have a constitutional convention set up, write up a constitution, then hold elections, and then hand over to the government that are emerged out of those elections, is far too slow and lumbering in view of the very pressing need to hand over power and, on one hand, allow Americans and Britons to pull back and also give the Iraqis a sense that this transfer is happening and that if they just hold on, Iraq will be back in the hands of the Iraqis. So what they've done is to open the gates to the possibility that there could be some kind of interim constitution, some sort of quick and dirty elections that got together a body that could in turn draw up a long-term constitution. So in a way, they've reversed the order of the course of events that they had in mind.
Of course, the report identifies a problem. The Iraqis think we're going to leave, that we're not there for the long haul. And then the administration changes its policy and signals that, in fact, we may not be there for the long haul by hastening this turnover of authority. Is there some worry that we're sending exactly the wrong signal, exactly the signal that the report says our lack of getting on top of this situation has already sent?
That's a very good point. They lose both ways, because if they stay on and don't transfer any sovereignty, then people obviously become impatient and feel that they're under occupation rather than they've been liberated. On the other hand, of course, by signaling that they're in a rush to hand over power, then it will obviously give encouragement to the people, the insurgents who've been trying to force them out of there, and lose credibility in the eyes of many ordinary Iraqis who want to know 5 years, 10 years down the line, who's going to be in charge.
Does the report itself recommend steps that the United States should take, or is it just an outline of the problem?
No, the report is, as far as that's possible in these circumstances, apolitical. It just outlines the severity of the problem, but does make a recommendation that the severity of the problem requires a change of course in terms of the U.S. plan, because it makes it clear that the Iraqi Governing Council doesn't have much credibility with ordinary Iraqis, and that's part of the problem.
And the idea is that the Iraqi Council could gain credibility if it had governmental powers and patronage and was seen to be working. Is that the notion?
The Governing Council all along has wanted to be a provisional government and wanted power handed over, and has said the reason why it's performed badly and why people don't turn up to meetings and so on, it all has its roots in this same problem that doesn't have enough power. But it's a sort of chicken and egg situation, and in the eyes of most people outside the Pentagon, the Governing Council isn't a fit body to accept the added responsibilities of full sovereignty, that it doesn't have credibility among ordinary Iraqis because it is chosen primarily from exiles. The well-known personality on it, of course, is Ahmed Chalabi, the head of the Iraqi National Congress, an exile who has a lot of support in the Pentagon, but it's questionable how much support he has in Iraq itself.
Is there any sense that Ambassador Bremer, by signing on to this report, is trying to, as it were, outflank the Pentagon supporters of Chalabi and sort of get to the president and say, we need to shake up this provisional authority, we need new people? Is there any of that politics going on here?
I think that's quite likely, because normally he would report directly to Donald Rumsfeld. By adding on a few comments, quite unusually in one of these CIA reports, situation reports, but basically endorsing it, he's sending a message directly to the White House. And it's quite possible that this is a way of getting his point across, that simply handing over power to the Iraqi Governing Council as it stands and getting out of there is a recipe for disaster.
Well, Julian, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Julian Borgia is a reporter for The Guardian newspaper. He spoke with me from Washington. In 1945, the first care packages were sent to war-torn Europe. These packages from the Cooperative for American Remittances in Europe, better known by that acronym CARE, the organization which lent its names to the packages is still known as CARE, but now the acronym is shorthand for the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere. From rebuilding Honduras after Hurricane Mitch to distributing food in Rwanda and Burundi, from providing clean drinking water for Iraqis to educating Afghani children, CARE's efforts in the past year have directly affected 31 million people and indirectly touched the lives of millions more. Tonight, the president of CARE USA, Peter Bell, talks about the tribulations and triumphs of humanitarian aid. Listeners, do you donate to aid organizations? Where do you think humanitarian help is most needed today? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Peter Bell, president of CARE USA. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Bell.
Thank you very much, Jack. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. Let's just start with sort of the headline. The International Red Cross, as you know, has withdrawn its workers from Iraq recently. And in September, six aid workers were killed in Afghanistan. Is CARE staying in these places?
Well, CARE does remain in Iraq, and we are working in Afghanistan and in some 70 other countries around the world, including a number of countries that are still in conflict.
And yet these other organizations are pulling out. What is the – is there a level at which you all would consider that, or how is it going for you there in general terms? I know you don't want to talk too much about Iraq simply because of the security situation there, but in general, what are you doing and how is it going?
CARE has been there for the last 12 years, and we have been principally engaged in repairing water systems, making them operable, serve literally millions of Iraqis. We have also been engaged in repairing health facilities, hospitals, just since the war, some 40 hospitals and more than 100 health centers. And we have also supplied food to vulnerable populations. So these are some of the major activities in which we have been engaged and continue to be engaged.
And in Afghanistan, what's going on there?
In Afghanistan, we have actually been in Afghanistan since 1960. And we did leave during the period of Soviet occupation. One of the things that often distinguishes CARE is that we will have been there for years before, at the time of the crisis itself, and then we realize that crises are not just while they're in the headlines, but when a disaster occurs, whether it be humanitarian or natural, man-made or natural, it goes on for years thereafter. So we were not there during the Soviet period, mm-hmm. from 79 mm-hmm. Until 89. But we then returned, and we were there throughout the Taliban period and are there today. It was, as you can imagine, extremely difficult during the Taliban period. And yet, even then, CARE worked with some 280 community schools. And even though the Taliban had decreed against the education of girls, 43% of the students in these schools were girls. Today, we're working with well over 400 schools.
How did you manage that? How did you manage to have a co-ed schools in Taliban Afghanistan?
Well, I keep talking about CARE, but actually CARE works with tens of thousands of the poorest communities in the world. And the secret in this case was the absolute commitment of the parents, the children, and the elders within these communities to the education of their children, including girls. Mm-hmm. So CARE trained the teachers. Mm-hmm. We provided the teaching materials. Mm-hmm. But these poor communities were able to come up with the money to pay the teachers. Often the classes were held in people's homes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we helped in the building of schools. Mm-hmm. But those schools got up and running. They ran all through the war, post-9/11. Mm-hmm. The communities insisted on keeping them going. And during the Taliban period, Taliban would knock at the door, open the door, and see these girls inside, and they would shudder, but quickly close the door and pretend they hadn't seen it because they knew of the parental support, and they just didn't want to run up against it.
And that model you just gave, you train the teachers. Is that, in fact, typical that instead of putting your own – I see you have 12,000 employees, yeah. But instead of sending your own people, you actually train and employ indigenous people.
Exactly. You know, in our beginning, as you suggested, CARE began as a food delivery organization, responding to the threat of famine in Europe after the Second World War. But today, in a sense, the CARE package – is much more likely to be education, training, technical assistance that will help to empower, to increase the capacities of local of poor communities to do things for themselves and to fend for themselves, to defend their rights and make rightful demands before their governmental authorities.
So there's a political dimension to this.
There is. There was a time when CARE would think of itself as being apolitical or non-political, but we've come to realize that the activity in which we engage has a very political nature to it. That doesn't mean that we're partisan. We're not partisan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you want to make people aware of their rights and how they can
absolutely
be responded to.
Their right to a basic education, mm-hmm. for example.
Mm-hmm. We're talking tonight about CARE USA and humanitarian aid. Our guest says extreme poverty can be eliminated in this century. Do you agree? What can organizations like CARE do? What should Western governments do? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about humanitarian organizations and the role of relief and aid in our world. On Point listeners, what do you see as the biggest crisis facing the poor in the world today? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Peter Bell, president of CARE International, one of the world's largest humanitarian aid organizations. Peter Bell, you mentioned, or in your one of your, I think an article about you in the Princeton Alumni Weekly mentioned that at Yale, when you were an undergraduate there, one of your professors, a professor of metaphysics, was a Holocaust, or relatives of his had died in the Holocaust. And he gave you a sort of working motto, it sounds, for your life and for the CARE activity, make the world less miserable. Toward that end, you say that extreme poverty can be eliminated in the world in this century. First of all, what is extreme poverty?
Extreme poverty is defined generally as living on $1 or less a day. Difficult as it seems, it's really hard to grasp that 1.2 billion people in the world live on less than $1 a day. Now, nearly half of humanity lives on $2 or less a day. Half the population of sub-Saharan Africa lives on just about what we would pay for a can of Coke a day. They live on 65 cents or less a day. It's almost impossible to imagine what that means. I mean, these are people who live each day on a razor's edge of crisis. And what we seek within CARE to do in the first instance is to identify their greatest vulnerabilities and their greatest opportunities, and to strengthen them, to protect their from their vulnerabilities, and to strengthen their opportunities. And we believe that there already exists in today's world the knowledge, the technology, and the wealth to end extreme poverty.
The will is the question.
The will is the question. It's a question of political will and organization.
You identify 10 ideas to help rid the world of poverty. The first one is to fight HIV/AIDS, which you say has, well, the death rate in Africa is 7,000 people a day. How is the world doing with that, and what should it do that's not being done, if this is one of the main ways to eliminate?
I say that, you know, the poorest area of the world is sub-Saharan Africa.
65 cents a day.
It's unbelievable, and it has, in a number of countries, have gotten poorer rather than less poor. The magnitude of the AIDS crisis is just very difficult to get your arms around. I visited Lesotho not so long ago, and there I met young man who had been a soccer star on the national team and is now working for CARE, doing outreach in the country. Why? Because he noted that the soccer leagues in Lesotho are falling apart. They're being disbanded. And why was that the case? Because they played on Saturdays, and there were so many of the members of the teams were attending 2, 3, 4 funerals a day that they could no longer field the team. And so he recruited from among them outreach workers for CARE to help spread the word about how to prevent AIDS. A 15-year-old in South Africa today faces a 50-50 prospect of dying from causes related to HIV/AIDS.
When you instance these stories, what is your reaction to the series of columns by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, which, to summarize them, basically shows how the politics of abortion
in especially family planning issues in China are directly affecting the fight against AIDS in Africa, because the U.S. government will not now aid organizations that counsel people on ways to avoid AIDS, because these same organizations are in China, and it's said that they are counseling people there to get abortion.
Right.
How do you react to that when you see these columns? There are four or five of them right now.
No, I know the specific case that you're talking about, and I did read those columns, and in fact, CARE was one of a half a dozen humanitarian organizations involved in the coalition that eventually turned down a U.S. government grant because the State Department had insisted that we drop from our coalition, an organization with which we had all worked for the past half dozen years, simply because they had worked in China. And we knew that that organization had, in fact, sought to be a moderating influence in China. We're very satisfied with their ethics. And this is a case, and it's really, I think, shameful, where we have an issue within this country around abortion. It's a very emotional issue, and it's one that some politicians in Washington have decided to load on to development assistance. Since they can't get their way within this country, you know, since people in developing countries don't vote in our election, they feel they can do it there in a relatively low-cost way. And it's, I think it's shameful, because our real concern is how to improve the livelihoods of, as I say, people who are extremely poor. And that takes an integrated approach. Practically speaking, the issue of abortion almost never comes up in the context in which we work. When it does come up, it's usually because people want to try to prevent abortion through family planning, through better spacing of their children, and so on. So it's unfortunate. It's really a red herring here.
And it's tragic for the people whose lives...
I think it's tremendously tragic for those people. And let me just end by saying, with regard to AIDS in Africa, this is truly a pandemic, and it most critically affects people in their most productive ages, especially teachers, health workers, farmers. And I believe that this is the most disastrous humanitarian crisis of our time, and quite possibly of all time. And stopping the spread of AIDS in Africa is an absolute precondition to development in Africa. That's why I put it number one on my list.
You also, deeper in the list, mention breaking the shackles of debt, debt relief as an anti-poverty strategy. Talk to us about that.
The issue of debt relief, you know, it's the case that some of the poorer countries in the world are paying out more in debt relief than they can possibly afford. It just makes no sense. They'd never get out from under because
they're
always paying out.
Borrowed from Western sources.
They shouldn't have borrowed it. It shouldn't probably have been lent to them. But now it's a reality. It's some years later, and they just can't get from out and under. And it makes no sense.
And yet there was talk a few years ago in regard to Africa about a year of jubilee, using the biblical idea of forgiveness for debt. Has that just ended, or is
no? There has been some relief too. It's just not sufficient.
Just not sufficient. So, but without debt relief, in effect, these countries, even when they're making economic progress, are sort of running in place.
That's
they're
exactly
just paying
right.
off yesterday. They're not being able to invest in infrastructure, in health, in education that could erratic help to alleviate poverty in the future.
That's exactly the point. And particularly when there are governments who want to do precisely what you just suggested, that is invest in those critical areas. I must say I'm less sympathetic if what they're thinking about doing is beefing up their military so they can attack their neighbors or something of that sort.
Now, isn't there a model in Chad now, a new sort of model about aid and that the government has made certain commitments about how it's going to spend its money? What is that Chad?
Yeah, I'm certainly no expert on the Chad situation. I have a daughter who happens to be studying it and going to Chad in January. But there, the World Bank and ExxonMobil and so forth have come together and they've built this pipeline, and there are resources from it, the pipeline for energy. And the agreement is that the payments will go, you know, in their fair measure to the government, and that the government will use them for presumably socially progressive purposes, that is, there'll be a sharing in the wealth within the country. I think that's the general outline. I really don't feel qualified specifically to support it or to criticize
it. Right. But it is a sort of new model, isn't it? That, all right, we're going to pay you a rent on this pipeline.
Exactly.
But we're earmarking what you can do with the proceeds.
Right. And in that sense, it could, under the best of circumstances, represent a kind of breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a tendency on the part of corporations in the past, you know, to take a kind of value-neutral position that's not our responsibility.
But here they're stepping up.
Here there's a coming together of the World Bank, ExxonMobil, and of the government. And, you know, I think, you know, critical here is, you know, what is to the participation of the communities who will be directly affected, and how will it play out in their environment and in their livelihoods?
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Mary in Arlington, Massachusetts. Hello, welcome.
Yes, good evening. Am I on?
You are indeed.
Okay. My comment is you asked earlier about what you thought might be, you invited us to call in with what we thought might
sure.
be the most severe crisis facing the poor people of the world. I have a strong feeling that what that is access to water. Mm. And I am really, really concerned that the methods that are being employed to provide that access, inadequate as they are in fact worsening the problem, because what's going on is a big investment in mining water out of aquifers that are already vastly depleted. And rather than adopting conservation measures that try to provide for people's needs within the parameters of what the rainfall is.
Ah, now that's quite an interesting picture. In other words, that what they're doing now, in Bangladesh. They're having problems precisely on this ground because the water in the aquifers is arsenic. Well, that's poison with arsenic.
Right.
It's the only way I can put it.
Right.
And they're not using the rainwater as much as they should. What's your response to that?
First, let me just back up for just a second and first agree with the caller. Mm-hmm. From my perspective, probably the two most important areas in which to support the development of poor communities are, one, basic education, and secondly, safe water. And the two go hand in hand. I think they're both absolutely critical. And safe water is important, first, for the health and life of people, obviously. And let me just cite that, you know, 3 million children a year die from diarrhea. It is the greatest killer of young children, and obviously safe water accompanied by hygiene is absolutely critical here.
What about the point she makes that current methods of mining this water out of aquifers is?
Let me just mention one other thing, and that is that in most poor countries around the world, it is the women who have the principal duty to fetch water and often spend hours each day looking for water. So that when you can bring water into a community, at least if not into the household itself, it means saving a considerable amount of women's time, and that's also critically important. And then finally, also water can be a cause of conflict when people have to go traipse across other people's property to get it. There's no question that she is right that water needs to be viewed in a more integrated, holistic way, and that, for example, micro watershed management needs to be seen as a critical part of the provision of clean water. It's not enough to just to focus in and dig wells or tap into springs. It needs to be viewed in a more holistic way, and that goes, too, to the way in which water itself is used. So I would hesitate to generalize across societies. Each situation is different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The one you mentioned in Bangladesh is tragic, where so much arsenic has been found.
And that was actually, as I understand it, the digging of the wells was a international aid organization-led effort precisely to make life better for the people, especially
absolutely.
For the women. And it backfired catastrophically.
That it is true. And that, you know, good intentions. Well, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
I think Mary is suggesting that maybe something similar is happening today with these, you know, not quite so. In other words, instead of using conservation, we're going in the wrong direction. International aid.
I don't think one could make that generalization by any means. In fact, there has been a huge increase over recent decades in the numbers of people in the world who have access to safe water.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's close to a billion people who still do not.
A billion people who do not have safe water.
Right.
Mike, Mary, thank you. Mike is calling from Cambridge, Mass. Hello, Mike.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Well, just fine. What can we do for you?
Well, I'm very excited that this topic has been talked about. I am a technologist based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and 2 years ago I visited Africa, and I was so inspired to develop technology that helped people like CARE International, the World Bank Consortium, like Doctors Without Borders, in carrying out their work, where they can use technologies to collect records of vaccinations, distribute food better so that you don't have rationeers cheating the system. And I was just incredibly discouraged after 2 years of trying to promote the technology for use. So my question is, what can someone like myself, a technologist from the private sector, do to sort of promote the use of wireless technology in the field with organizations like CARE?
Well, that's a good
right.
question. Peter Bell?
We do have an IT information technology unit within CARE.
We're going to stop you right there. And, Mike, hang on. We're going to come back to you after the break to talk about this more. Thank you. We're talking about poverty eradication in the 21st century with Peter Bell, president of CARE USA. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about humanitarian aid in the fight against global poverty with Peter Bell, president of CARE USA. What are your questions about the role of humanitarian aid in an inhumane world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike called with a question. Right. Basically, he had been in Africa and had been disappointed that information technology was not being harnessed to keep track of medical records and to do that sort of thing in the health infrastructure. And, of course, his question raises the broader point about what role does technology have in this goal, you say, is possible of alleviating extreme poverty in this century?
Well, first of all, one of the characteristics of extreme poverty is extreme disconnectedness.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
people in the communities that we've been discussing tend to be very disconnected from the rest of the world. That's part of the reason for the emphasis on basic education.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really very challenging to figure out how better to connect them with the rest of the world. it's almost impossible for us to imagine just how poor people are in the remote parts of places like southern Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Afghanistan. I do think that lots more can be done over the coming years in using technology and perhaps leapfrogging over some of the development that we've gone through in the United States and in Europe. But right now, there are parts of the world in which we work that, you know, we can't even maintain connectivity as we would like with our own country offices around the world. I mean, that's part of the challenge. So we need people. We need people like Mike. We need those people on our staff, and we have hooked up with them, too. We have, for example, within CARE, the year before last, we had six fellows from Cisco working with us on a whole set of mm-hmm. these IT issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the threshold problem is simply the as you say, these people aren't connected to the 20th century, much less the 21st, in some fundamental way in terms of communication. No telephones, perhaps rudimentary mail service.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No telephones. Yeah. No, sometimes no roads.
No roads, yeah.
You know, it's... But I want to encourage Mike to stay with it.
What about the role of appropriate technology?
Well, you know, I'm not saying that in some cases IT couldn't be mm-hmm. appropriate. But what constitutes appropriate technology varies mm-hmm. so much. I remember in visiting in a remote area of Nepal, mm-hmm. and there in the lower caste communities, women who are about to give birth are considered unclean, and they're consigned to a stable to give birth on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things CARE does well, I think, is to work within the local culture.
Mm-hmm.
So we train local birth attendants who stand in the door of the stable.
Mm-hmm.
And then, whereas the tradition had been to sort of toss the pregnant woman a rusty sickle with which to cut the umbilical cord, our appropriate technology was a sterile razor blade.
Mm-hmm. A razor blade. And,
you know,
saving lives, infections.
And it's
yes.
saved lives.
Of course.
So, and wherever possible, we try to use local materials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Mike. Enrique is calling from Boston. Hello. Welcome.
Hello. Well, just a quick comment. Somebody mentioned, that countries, why did they request so much in funds to borrow if they can't repay them? And one of the issues, I think, and nobody talks about is corruption. Corruption, countries are in those conditions, not because they don't know how to do things, but because the leaders of those countries just make with the money and with the resources whatever they want. So
yes.
My question is, who is monitoring corruption in those countries, and what has been done about it?
Right. It's a fair question. And again, I think it's hard to make generalizations. I certainly don't think we should be forgiving debts just so that leaders can pocket the money. But there are tremendous variations among countries. One of the things that CARE has increasingly been doing is working with groups in poor communities to hold government accountable. You know, if they have gone to the Ministry of Education and been able to persuade them to put a zinc roof over their school building, and they know that the minister has signed a contract, and a month and 6 months go by and that roof doesn't arrive, those people have a right to go back to the government to demand that that roof be there and to demand that the officials of the government be held accountable. I think in the end, yes, donor organizations like the World Bank and the U.S. Agency for International Development and CARE, we can do our part to try to hold governments accountable. But it's also important that the people themselves demand accountability from their government.
Mm-hmm. Enrique, thank you. George is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hello and welcome.
Thank you. My question is, with the loss of arable land in the United States and other parts of the world, and with the growth of the human population as it is, if we do redistribute the wealth in the world and we do find a cure for AIDS and malaria and typhoid, where will we be in 50 or 100 years or even 25 years when we cannot feed everyone in the world just because of the lack of natural resources?
A Malthusian prospect,
yeah.
When you say
no,
that.
I don't see it going that way. Agricultural productivity within the world has been rising at very encouraging rates. I think it's fantastic that today India, for example, is more than self-sufficient in grains. India has an enormous surplus of grains.
Mm-hmm.
India is sending surplus grain to Afghanistan and to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't many years ago that when one wouldn't have thought that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think, if you look around the world, in the more prosperous countries, people are spacing their children more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And as equity for women increases around the world, as education for girls increases around the world, family health will be better, children will be better spaced. I see the world getting better. I think also the chances, the degree to which prosperity is shared around the world, I think it is more likely that there will be less conflict around the world. I think the world that you're describing is going to be a better world.
Got to be a better world, and yet if you look at Africa in the 1960s and you look at it today, it is a fall. The line just goes like this in every indicator and in some places in Latin America as well. I mean, is that just a blip, or is that you're saying that's not a trend, or that that's an arrestable trend?
I strongly believe that it is. There's been enormous progress in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the 20th century, in the entire 20th century, there was only one decade in which the absolute numbers of poor people in the world actually declined. And that was in the 1990s.
In the 1990s.
And it was driven by China and India.
Mm-hmm.
And, the progress in China and India is really terrific. And the progress in much of Asia has been very encouraging. And while Latin America has had its ups and downs and has certainly had its economic problems, overall, I think there's been progress in Latin America if you look over the decades.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're talking not only about, financial measures, but also access to education, access to clean water, mm-hmm. access to health care, and so on.
Things are better.
Absolutely. Now, sub-Saharan Africa is very uneven, and that's really a euphemism. Numbers of countries, perhaps more than 20 countries, have actually moved backward over the last decades. And certainly conflict and HIV/AIDS have mm-hmm. been an important part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And poor governance hasn't helped either.
And has globalization helped these countries? I mean, one reads, for example, that 25,000 cotton farmers in the United States get more money in subsidy from our government than the entire AID budget for sub-Saharan Africa. Now, that's not necessarily globalization. Yeah. That's sort of anti-globalization.
Well,
but that's the reality of globalization.
I think it isn't that globalization as such is good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Globalization needs to be shaped in ways that are fairer mm-hmm. than it has been. What has happened is that sub-Saharan Africa has been almost completely left out of globalization so
mm-hmm.
far.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the United States has now made some special exceptions that let in some crops from Africa, and that's making it some difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's hope we can make some more. Peter Bell, Director of CARE International, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. Continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, a letter written by an Italian soldier before he was killed in Iraq on Wednesday. This is On Point. The bodies of 18 Italian soldiers killed in Wednesday's truck bomb attack in Nasiriyah, Iraq, will be flown home in brown wooden coffins tomorrow. They will lie in state on Monday in Rome to allow the grieving nation to pay its respects. One of the soldiers killed in the attack was Sergeant Alfio Ragazzi. 2 months before he died, Ragazzi sent a letter home to his family describing his life in Iraq. The letter was published in the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera on Thursday. Here is that letter, read by WBUR's Kim Beccari.
Dear family, 2 months have passed since I left our country, and even though there are thousands of kilometers between us, I can constantly feel your thoughts and Granny's prayers for me. Things are quite okay here, despite the fact that journalists do their best to make our loved ones back home worry, and the news bulletins yell out the news. We always receive communiques of the terror attacks that take place in the north, and sometimes the alert level is raised here too. But being true Italian and with our football spaghetti policy, we have immediately managed to win everybody over. Wherever we go, we're met with sympathy and esteem. Italy good, say the Mau Mau, but it is the children in particular who go crazy when they spot our blue cars. They run after us and shout, Mr. Water or Mr. Food, which has become our trademark. On a practical level, my squad and I have started a humanitarian aid campaign. We supply hospitals, mainly children's hospitals, which are in a pitiful state, with various goods and medicines. When we leave Nasiriyah to go on a mission, we often come across isolated villages where everything seems to have stopped at the time of the Sumerians. Houses built with a mix of mud and straw, ovens made with hollow pottery where dung is used as fuel, bread made with flour ground by hand, and food they gather after walking for several hours. They drink water from the river and eat meat on special days. The difference with our Western civilization is unbelievable and difficult to understand unless you experience it firsthand. Apart from the outside world, life at the camp is perfectly Italian. Lots of pasta and no shortage of bottled water, apart from some occasions when we celebrate K-Day and eat combat lunch packs. All considered, after the initial period of acclimatization, which was really hard, things are becoming more normal. We sleep in a bed, wash ourselves every day, we have a laundry service and eat at a canteen. In short, time goes by and the days before we can meet again are fewer and fewer and go by increasingly faster. I urge you not to worry too much. A big hug and see you soon. Yours, Alfio.
A letter from Italian Sergeant Alfio Ragazzi to his family, written 2 months before he was killed in Wednesday's truck bomb attack in Nasiriyah, Iraq. The letter was read by WBUR's Kim Beccari. I'm Jack Beattie, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.